Hope you have your Bibles as we open them to Revelation chapter 3. After tonight, only one more of these churches will be addressed before we get into more of the prophetic parts of this letter. Tonight, we are going to look at the church that was located in Philadelphia. Revelation chapter 3, verse 7 says, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write." Many of the other cities that have been looked at, like Thyatira and Sardis and Pergamum and Ephesus, were very, very old cities. Philadelphia was not a very old city. It was a fairly new city compared to those others. It is, just like the others, it was located in what we would call today modern Turkey, and you know that, you know, it wasn't too long ago that certain parts of Turkey had one of the worst earthquakes in history, and it devastated that part of the country. Well, Philadelphia, that city, was located in a very earthquake-prone area in the first century. And that constant awareness of an earthquake happening at any time plays into this letter. And you see part of that idea expressed when Jesus writes this letter to the church in Philadelphia. It was a city with a number of temples and altars, and it was often called Little Athens because it had so many of these buildings with pillars and so forth, much like the great city of Athens at the time. But let's get right into the letter and see what Jesus says to the church in Philadelphia. He says, "These things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens." We have a very unique description here of the author in some ways. He is holy. He is pure. He is perfectly sinless. No darkness in him, no sin in him whatsoever. This one is true. He is faithful. The truth abides in him. He is the truth. He's the way, the truth, and the life. We know Jesus said that about himself. He's also said to be the one that has the key of David, and this is very significant. This is probably one of the most significant things he says to the church in Philadelphia. He has the key of David. We mentioned this morning in our Bible class when we were looking at Matthew chapter 16, verses 18 and 19, about how Peter in that particular place, text, was given the keys to the kingdom. And we talked about the significance of the keys, that it gave someone rights, it gave him authority, it gave him power to open and to close. Now, Jesus is said to be the one that has the key of David. And, of course, the significance of that is many. There's a great significance attached to having the key of David. The people there would certainly know who David was, the great monarch, and it was, of course, through him that the Messiah was going to come. This person is said to have the key of the house of David. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 22, which seems to be an allusion to what he's talking about. Isaiah 22, verse 22. Isaiah 22, verse 22. This particular section of Isaiah is a clear prophecy about the coming of the Messiah. Isaiah 22, verse 22 says, "The key of the house of David I will lay on his shoulder, so he shall open and no one shall shut, and he shall shut and no one shall open. I will fasten him as a peg in a secure place, and he will become a glorious throne to his father's house." Again, it's a prophecy about the coming of the Messiah. Now, Jesus applies it to himself. If you're still in Isaiah, go back a few pages to Isaiah chapter 9 and notice verses 6 and 7. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. You'll recognize these verses. It says, "And for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Again, a prophecy about the Messiah. What would Messiah have? There would be no end to his kingdom. He would be upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, and he would order it and establish it with judgment and justice. And of course, the idea being not that he was going to establish a physical throne in Jerusalem and reign over a physical kingdom, but that the Messiah would be the king over a spiritual kingdom. And the Messiah was a direct descendant of David. And so Jesus was given the key of David. He was given the authority and the rights, the power to rule over this particular kingdom. And with that power, it says he was given the power to open and no one could shut it. He was given the power to shut and no one could open it. Again, we seem to be looking at the same type of idea that is presented in Matthew chapter 16. Keys meaning it is open to some people, but when it's open to some people, that means it's closed to others. There are some who are included, there are some who are excluded. And the only person that has the right to do that is Jesus. Jesus then delegated that right to the apostles on the day of Pentecost. Those apostles did not have the power to choose in and of themselves who would be able to enter the kingdom and who would not. That was given from God Himself. They were simply allowed to tell people how they could enter the kingdom. And again, that was a divine right. A divine right. It's Jesus' kingdom. He could decide who's in it. He can decide who's not. So He opens and no one can shut. He shuts and no one can open. Man or no group of men ever have had the right to change the right or the way to get into that kingdom. Nobody has that. So He says He's the one that opens and no one shuts and shuts and no one opens. As is often the case, He says, "I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door and no one can shut it." Same idea. "For you have a little strength, have kept my word and have not denied my name." Apparently the church in Philadelphia was not very strong in numbers. Didn't have a lot of maybe powerful people in the congregation. But Jesus knew all about them, knew everything they were doing, knew they were faithful, knew they were doing what they needed to do. And so He says, "I've set before you an open door. I have given you some great opportunities. And I'm giving you some great opportunities." And He says, "You've got this little strength. You've kept my word and have not denied my name." And of course, that goes back to the worship of the emperor, emperor worship. The people who were involved in that would go around to the individuals, especially it was strong in this area. And they would try and force people to deny that they were a Christian, and they would try and force people to bow down to the emperor. So Jesus here is commending them for the fact that they have not done that. They have not denied His name. They've not bowed down to the emperor, but they were following just exactly what God wanted them to do. And so all the possible opportunities, the doors and so forth that had been opened for them, no one could shut but themselves. They could shut it. And I think there's a great lesson for us today about opportunities. You know, some opportunities are once in a lifetime, aren't they? They are. They're once in a lifetime opportunities. We don't like to think about having one chance to talk to someone about their salvation. But sometimes that's the case. Sometimes it is a one-time deal and we never have that opportunity again. And it's lost forever. Now, that doesn't mean someone else may be able to take advantage of that down the road. But it may mean for us that we have one opportunity. And if we don't take advantage of it, it's lost to us forever. I think that's a lesson we need to take home from this great letter. So he says, I know who you are. I know what you're doing. I know you're faithful. And it's because they were faithful that these opportunities were there. The doors were open. Regardless of where the doors went and to whom they were open, they were given by God, and it was because they were faithful. God does not use the unfaithful people in His service like that. It's because they were faithful that He used them, not the other way around. It was because they were faithful, and so God was using them. Even though they had little strength, God was using that strength. He was using what strength they had to advance that kingdom. In a very difficult place. So Jesus says, this is what I'm going to do. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, and this is at least the third time He's mentioned that, in this area, different congregations, had synagogues of Satan living in that area. Who were they? They say they are Jews, but they're not. They weren't spiritual Israel. Yes, they were Jewish people, but what did these Jewish people do? They denied that Jesus was the Messiah, just like Jewish people today do. That hasn't changed in 1900 years. Jewish people back then were denying that Jesus was the Messiah, and they still do. So he says, they claim they are Jews, but they're not. They lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. You know, this is an area where premillennialists make a huge mistake today. They raise up the Jewish people as being God's special people. God condemns them in the Bible. He doesn't raise them up in a special way showing favor. He condemns them just like Jesus is here. Jesus is condemning them because they didn't believe in the Messiah. And yet, those countless millions of people who believe in premillennialism deny what Jesus says here. Just completely deny it. I choose to believe what the Bible says, not what is taught so commonly on TV and radio. Jesus calls them a synagogue of Satan, and He uses those terms intentionally. Synagogue, of course, was the place of worship. And of course, the Jews were using that a great deal in the first century. And so He uses that expression, this Jewish place of gathering to worship, and He says, that's really a synagogue of Satan, not of God. And why? It was because they were denying that Jesus was the Messiah, that Jesus wasn't the Son of God, that He wasn't the true one, that He wasn't the Holy One, that He didn't have the key of David. See, they denied, and they still do today, that Jesus has the key of David. They deny that. So God here calls them a synagogue of Satan, which is pretty strong language. And He says in that verse that I'm going to give you victory. He says, I'm going to make them come and worship before your feet. Doubtful if He's talking literally there. I guess He could be. But He did promise them victory over this synagogue of Satan. Just how this was done is not stated, though. It doesn't say how that was going to be accomplished. And people have had different ideas whether that was going to be before the judgment or after the judgment. Certainly, after the judgment, there is no doubt that those people who denied Jesus would get their just deserts. But maybe before as well. He says, you have kept my command to persevere. You have kept my command to persevere. They had shown Jesus, they had displayed the type of endurance and perseverance and steadfastness that Jesus showed during His life. Jesus came into the world, He had a purpose. And He was very steadfast and He persevered so that purpose was fulfilled. And so Jesus says, you've kept my command to persevere. You've followed my ways to persevere. You've done that. So he says, because of that, I will keep you from the hour of trial. Well, which hour of trial? Well, it doesn't say, but certainly there were many types of trials that they were going to experience, and they were experiencing some right then. Whether he was talking about that hour of trial or maybe some in the future, it doesn't say. But he does say, I'll keep you from the hour of trial, which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. I wish we knew everything that that verse implied. We know some things for sure that it implies. It teaches that God was going to keep them in some way from that hour of trial. What's the worst thing that can happen to a Christian during an hour of trial, during persecution, during suffering? What's the worst thing? They leave God. They leave the Lord. That's the worst thing. And it's very possible that's what he's alluding to. Because that's the worst thing that could happen. You know, we think that, you know, what if the Lord's church was the main, what if it was the government religion? What if the Church of Christ was the government religion? And boy, that would get rid of all the persecutions and sufferings and all of that, and the church would be strong. Now, that's not historically what happens. We go back to, you know, the late 300s when the leader Constantine made the church the religion of the country, of the empire. What happened to the church right after that? Went straight down. That's what happened to it. Went straight down. So when the struggle was taken away from the church went into apostasy. The church became unfaithful because that struggle was taken away. I think the same thing very possibly would happen today. If all of that was taken away from us, then we might get soft and lazy and unconcerned, and the church could go off into apostasy as well. But when you look at historically, you go back from the first century to today, you see that the times when there was very little suffering, very little persecution, that's when the church was very weak. Very weak. And often went off into some type of apostasy. And it seemed like when the church was struggling, that's when it was growing. I guess they say, you know, when they talk about growth pains, they know what they're talking about. And maybe that's a lesson we can take home from this as well. So he says, some difficult times are coming. And God never says that we're not going to experience difficult times. He says just the opposite, doesn't he, throughout the New Testament. He says Christians are going to experience difficult times. That's much of what the first chapter of James is about, right? What comes from trials and difficulties and sufferings, our faith gets stronger. That's what he says. James chapter 1, I think, starting in verse 3. It gets stronger because of that, because of the struggle, because of the difficult times. It makes us stronger. Jesus goes on and says then, behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. Now that is a whole sermon in and of itself, that one verse. Just what a rich, 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 rich verse. First of all, Jesus says, I'm coming quickly. Couldn't possibly be alluding to him coming back to the earth, because that was 1900 years ago. So how was Jesus going to come? Many of the times that Jesus talks about coming, even in Matthew chapter 24, that coming was in judgment upon people. Not coming the second time to, you know, to destroy the world and divide the sheep from the goats, but coming in judgment. Even the prophets talked about how God would often come on people and he would come in judgment upon them. And that seems to be what he's talking about here. Not the second coming, but he was going to come to help them, not personally, not physically, not literally come, but providentially he was going to help them. He was going to be with them, be by their side. So he's going to bring judgment upon the world, which he did, right? Which is much of, you know, Revelation chapter 4 all the way through Revelation chapter 19. Those 16 chapters talk about Jesus coming in judgment on people in the world, and in particular, of course, the Roman Empire. But that's later. So Jesus says, I'm coming quickly. I'm coming quickly to your aid. To your aid. And he did that. He says, hold fast what you have. Now, if I can't lose it, why do I have to hold fast to it? Why would I have to hold fast to something I'm not going to lose? You know, we've had a lot of wind the past couple of days, and you go outside with the hat on. If there was no possibility of that hat being blown off, then why would you ever put your hand on it when you went out in the wind or hold on to the bill or whatever? If there was no possibility of the hat blowing off, why would you hold fast to it? Well, you wouldn't. It'd be pointless. But Jesus says here, hold fast to what you have. What's he talking about? He says that no one may take your crown. Paul talked about that, right? The end, almost the very last thing he said in his writings. He said, I fought a good fight, kept the faith, finished the course. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. He says it wasn't just for him, it's for everybody who's faithful, who loves Jesus appearing. So he says, hold fast what you have that no one may take your crown. Someone can take it. Someone can take your crown. Once you have the crown, doesn't mean you're going to have it forever. You can lose it. Contrary to the beliefs of tens of millions of people, you can lose your crown. And if that verse doesn't mean you can lose your crown, what in the world does it possibly mean? What could it possibly mean in that verse? He says, hold fast to your crown. Because someone can take it from you. You give it up. You can give up your crown if you want to. Countless people have done that for decades, for centuries. They've given up their crown because they've let somebody take it. So I can lose it. You can lose it. Everybody can lose it that has it. So it says, hold fast to it. He says, he who overcomes, there's the main word in Revelation, he who overcomes, the overcoming ones, are going to do something. They're going to be blessed. How? I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. That's the first thing. And of course, again, thinking about how earthquake prone this area was, you know, the pillar is symbolic of endurance and staying the course and being around after the earthquake. So he says, those who overcome, those who keep the faith all the way through their life, he says, I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more, and I will write on him the name of my God. When you're named after somebody, that implies ownership, doesn't it? That you're a part of that person. When I was born a Stafford. I'm part of that family. And he says, I'm going to write on him the name of my God. There's the idea of being a part of something, being a possession, ownership. God owns you. And the name of the city of my God. There's our citizenship, right? We're not citizens of this world anymore. We now are citizens, as we talked about this morning, Ephesians chapter 2. We are citizens of that new kingdom. And he calls it the New Jerusalem, right? Revelation chapter 21. John in his revelation sees what? The New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. the new Jerusalem which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. That's a promise, that's a blessing, that's something that's going to be given to those people who are faithful, who overcome. If there were no persecutions, if there were no sufferings, if there were no trials, what would there be to overcome? Nothing. Overcome tells us that there is something we have to come over. So there are these difficult times and trials and persecutions and sufferings and temptations, all these things. Without them, as I mentioned a while ago, we would probably go off into apostasy. When life becomes that easy, we quit struggling, we quit working, we quit trying, we quit putting forth effort, and therefore we become lazy and lethargic and we die. So maybe we should never pray that all the persecutions and trials and sufferings would go away, even though we may want them to go away. That's what makes us stronger. And that's what history teaches us as well. And we'll be seeing a lot of that in the coming months when we look at Revelation 4 going on, from the bowls of wrath and the seals being opened and all of that. And so he ends up by saying, he who has an ear, his common ending to the letter, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. You know, there is a standard by which we are judged, right? Jesus told his followers that the words that he spoke to them would judge them in the last day. So Jesus says, listen to what the Spirit says. Listen to what the Spirit says. Keep your ears open. Be open-minded to hear what the gospel actually says. Because there is a standard. The Bible does have authority. And of course, it comes from God. That's where the authority comes from. Jesus opens and no one can shut. Jesus shuts and no one can open. Jesus has clearly set forth how someone enters that kingdom. It's by an obedient, penitent faith that leads to an immersion in water. You or I can't change that in any way. People change those entrances or those terms all the time, but people can't get into the kingdom that way. You know, if there's a lock on the door, there's only one key that fits it. I can go tell people, well, this is the key that actually opens it, but it doesn't really open it. And people think they're actually in the kingdom when in reality they're not. Why? Because people are setting forth the wrong key. They're saying, this is the key. Jesus says, no, it's not. I have the key. No one else does. He sets forth the conditions, the terms upon entering the kingdom. No one else does. And those haven't changed. Same ones that were presented over 1900 years ago. Again, it's based on a penitent, obedient faith that leads to a new birth. It also leads to a life of constant confession, asking for forgiveness, a starting over, like 1 John 1, verses 7 through 9. We have to continue to confess our sins, continue to ask for forgiveness. Those are the conditions, those are the keys, those are the terms of entrance and staying in the kingdom and keeping our crown, because we can indeed lose it. Let us think about these things, and if you need to respond, please do as we stand and sing this song.